It's time for another episode of Lit Period, our tour through Western literature's literary periods. And regular listeners know what that means. There's a brand new free packet of artistically curated notes waiting for you on our website. To download them, visit www.centerforlit.com/litperiod11. And that's all one word, www.centerforlit.com/LITPERIOD, the number 11. We've also provided a link in the show notes for this episode. So, without further ado, let's get started.
Welcome to Bibliophiles, a production of the Center for Lit podcast network. In today's episode, the Center for Lit team continues its quest to discover the great ideas in books of every description, ancient classics to new bestsellers, epic poems to bedtime stories. We're glad you came along. We hope you find this discussion as provocative and inspiring as the books themselves. Want to join the great conversation? Stay tuned. You've come to the right place.
Welcome to Bibliophiles, everyone. It's the Andrews family on our second introduction attempt. How's everybody doing
awesome.
Today?
Awesome. Great.
Emily, are you going to have to cut that
no,
one?
No, that one's a great introduction. Let's roll.
Okay, good. All right, we're rolling. So today, the topic on the table is another lit period. We've taken a little break from lit periods. And actually, in going backwards over our history to decide which period we were going to take up together today, I noticed that we did a horrible job of doing it in anything like chronological order over the course of our history together. We've done just a grab bag of interesting periods. So maybe starting now, we'll try and do them in order. Who knows?
Nah. No, we won't. We never do anything in an orderly fashion.
I'm going to need some hope out of you, Emily. Hope! So today we are taking up the Victorian period. And we've decided to focus, I believe, on prose and maybe fiction particularly, rather than on poetry, because there's just so much in this period to discuss that we will get waylaid, I'm sure, if we don't focus a little bit. So let's kick it off. The Victorian period, where and when? Any takers?
Well, the Victorian period is named after Queen Victoria, so we're talking about England and the English dominions, and that's the where. But the when is a subject of debate, right? Because
outline
Victoria took the throne of England in 1837.
Which is not debatable. That's just historical.
This is not debatable.
That's historical.
Well, just let me finish. She lived, she took the throne in 1837 and ruled until she died in 1901. And so that's the period of Queen Victoria's life. So that's the Victorian period in British history. But the Victorian period in literature is the edges are a little bit more malleable because of the fact that a period in literature is defined not only by the dates that give it its name, but also by the lives of the trends that make it up. The ideas that are prevalent in a period may begin in seed form before the period formally begins, and they may last after it ends. Right? It's not like the literary world said, aha, now we will begin the Victorian period. Everyone start writing differently.
Now we are Victorians. Right. Exactly, of course. Okay, but I have a question too as it relates to the when, or I'm sorry, to the where. So as I was reading about this a little bit, it appears to me that there is literature that's similar from a lot of different parts of the world during the period that we may not say, oh, this is Victorian literature because it isn't actually from England in the reign of Queen Victoria, but it happens around the same time and maybe even takes up some similar ideas. Is that so?
Yes, that's
sure.
So.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And that's not just true during the Victorian period. That's true in every period.
Well, this one in particular, I think, is interesting because the novel was rising to the surface kind of for the first time, having its first official day in the sun. There had been novels before, but this was really and truly the time of the novel. And so each culture was trying to figure out what that meant for them. And so I think it's appropriate to isolate the British novel. But, I mean, the threads do appear in the American novel. They just look American instead of British. And the ideas are American instead of British. And so they're different.
I agree with that. And I think that mentioning the novel like you do and mentioning that this is the novel's first great day in the sun is really apropos, because you could think of Mark Twain as writing a Victorian style novel, even though it's very American, by saying that he wrote a novel. and the novel mm-hmm. has the shape that novels have. And you can give the Victorians some credit, the English, the British Victorians, some credit for making that form, making that genre ascendant in the years of Victoria's reign.
Well, he also was a realist, like many of the Victorians were. And so there's that crossover as well. We saw this when we talked about the Romantics, that there are waves of a particular intellectual movement, mm-hmm. and it hops the pond, so to speak, and Americans experienced it as well and had their own version of Romanticism. I think that we can see the influence of Victorian thought and ideas also hopping the pond.
Mm, interesting.
Well, yeah, we should talk about how they are reacting to Romanticism, which is what came beforehand.
Well, quick before we do that, though, as it relates to the form of the novel, one more thing before we move on to the philosophies here. Just to clarify from the previous episode, what primary literary form is the novel sort of taking over from? What was the central work, the most popular work of the previous era?
That would be poetry. In the Romantic period, poetry was in
poetry and plays.
Yes, but predominantly poetry. That's when lyrical ballads came out, and the poetic movement was away from. Oh, we had a whole podcast on this issue, so I don't really need to tread the old ground again, but it was a movement away from the neoclassical ideal, where the poet mm-hmm. was—he was a student, an academic, a classicist, and he was, you know, really concentrated on forms, and he was basically looking at the world and trying to project the world to present the world to his reader mm-hmm. like a mirror, whereas in Romantic thought, the poet was really more interested in turning that mirror inward and talking about mm-hmm. how that world, that natural world, made him feel.
But as a right. question of form, what you're suggesting is that the poem, the lyric, the ballad, the poem as a form sort of embodied that romantic spirit.
Absolutely.
Maybe quintessentially. It isn't to say that there aren't romantic novels.
Of
Frankenstein jumps immediately to mind.
The Gothic novel. But the Gothic novel continues to develop in the Victorian age.
Well, and don't you think it is tied into the philosophy and the form, because it's appropriate for the philosophy of realism to turn to the novel as its predominant form?
Okay, so it's time then for the what? What ideas are swimming around in this soup? What philosophies are these authors primarily concerned with?
Emily, you should explain what you mean by realism.
Well, the idea is that the realists got fed up with the Romantics and how wishy-washy they were and how feely, and they wanted to return to a picture of life as it actually was. Mm-hmm. And so the descriptions inherent in the novel, right, the characterization, trying to depict life as one actually experiences it, is what defines realism.
So Victor Frankenstein doesn't really have any place in a realistic novel, in a novel of realism, does he?
Well, no, because he's more of a symbolic right. figurehead than he is an actual right. person with human feelings.
A thinking, feeling character.
Yeah.
Well, he feels all right, totally, but maybe true. Not realistically.
Totally, you can see, though, that in addition to this break with the Romantics, there's a continuation and a development of what the Romantics were experiencing and reacting to in their own generation. For example, industrialization. Wordsworth wrote, "The world is too much with us." That particular sonnet talking about industrialization and the mood that it's casting over the city and the way it's separating man from nature. In the Victorian period, this industrialization had kind of grown and blossomed and was affecting the mood and the temperament of the Victorian people. There's this movement more and more away from the country and from families, and the cities instead were becoming very overcrowded. There was gross poverty. Most of the cities hadn't actually been created to handle such an influx of population, and so it was very dirty, unsanitary conditions, and that also affected the workplace. There were factories growing up. This was the time of the Crystal Palace. So lots of invention, lots of expansion, but simultaneously, not a lot of laws governing how factories could be run, the treatment of workers. Mm. So, of course, that was an issue.
So,
that came
a lot of
period.
A lot of advancement and progress, maybe from a bird's eye mm-hmm. view, that does a lot of trampling on the little guy.
Yeah, especially children, women, workers. You know, so you see a lot of that coming up in works like the works of Charles Dickens. He hits all those bases. He's talking about the exploitation of children, and Elizabeth Gaskell talking about the exploitation of factory workers, right?
So in America, the Industrial Revolution happens a little bit later in the 19th century than it had in England. And so it's good to keep in mind when you think about the Industrial Revolution and the social problems that became rife in its wake. You tend to think, well, that's late 19th century, maybe even early 20th century when those problems are really... become acute, but it's the better part of a century earlier in
England.
Yeah. So by the time Victoria is on the throne, the actual flowering of industrialization is beginning to occur. Whereas Wordsworth would have seen it coming and Thoreau would have seen it coming mm-hmm. and have been troubled by it in sort of a romantic way and a philosophical way. The Victorians are right in the middle of it by the middle of the 19th century, by 1850 and certainly 1860 and 1870. So it's happening a little earlier in England than in America.
So the works that we're going to talk about now as we move on into sort of who and what and talking about our favorite books from the period, the works that we find that are Victorian literature on the English side of the ocean are going to be dealing with those issues directly, and the works on the American side of the ocean are going to be, as you said, predicting them and grappling with their oncoming.
Yeah,
vision,
maybe. And right? Yeah. And I also think that Americans are Victorians only at one remove.
Right.
Because 19th century American writers are primarily concerned with American topics. And some of those are uniquely American. Westward expansion and, you know, the role of slavery uh-huh. in a expanding economy and American concerns like that. The Victorians proper are
they're English.
Distinctly English, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What about the Victorian cliche that's been passed down? When I picture Victorian literature, I imagine high collars and very tight-laced figures. There's always this idea that the Victorians were very concerned with morality.
And of course they were. And I'm glad that you mentioned that, because that segues to exactly what I was going to talk about. The advancement of rationalism and scientific thinking was displacing the role of the church as the source of truth in this particular time period. This is largely because of the publication of The Origin of Species, which frankly can't be overstated in terms of the splash that it made on the scene. You know, I think that by itself can explain what you're talking about, the intense moralism, because if you think about it, the world was held to its moorings by the church until this time, uh-huh. largely. And now, fact was God, right? And fact and faith were separated, wrongly, but they were separated in the intellectual sphere. And, you know, church was kept in its churchy place, and science, well, it ascended as sort of a god of the era. Mm-hmm. And with this in mind, if you think about man as nothing but matter, which is essentially what The Origin of Species allows man to do, if man started out as a single-celled organism and all creatures came out of that single-celled organism, there's no distinctive to man. Mm-hmm. He's no longer the crown mm-hmm. of creation with a dominion mandate, right, telling him how to live and what to do. And furthermore, if there's no God necessary in this equation, then morality can't really exist except by fiat, by somebody in mm-hmm. power socially saying,
decreeing it
in a top-down sort of a way. This is what we are all going to do and think about this issue. There's no outside source of truth.
Well, it sounds like there's no shared moral imagination,
era. But of course there was. So thinking Victorians were troubled by this situation. But The Origin of Species was painted as this kind of progress. Science was progress, and we're all for progress. So there was a disconnect, and they had to find some sort of stay to fasten the good ship to.
Yeah. I like that that term, a stay. I had a college professor who described what you're talking about as kind of a destabilizing of an Augustinian view of the world. There was an Augustinian view where man's telos, man's end, was to reach heaven by loving God and loving one's neighbor. And all of that, because perhaps of the social structure expanding so rapidly and individualism coming into the forefront, there's a fundamental disconnect and a destabilizing. And the Victorians, I can kind of see them grabbing at whatever they can to center themselves once God is kind of put into question. Man's purpose, man's telos, is fundamentally put on the back foot. And so you can see the Victorians searching for a new telos.
And creating some sort of a, the emphasis on virtue and the moral didacticism you see in particular in emerging children's literature of the period, because this is really where children's literature had its heyday in the Victorian period. There's a lot of myth. In addition, in Great Britain in this time, I believe that children, not only were they taken care of via the laws because they were in such vulnerable position in the factories and places like that. So there was a lot of legislation governing how long children could work and things like that. There also was legislation that made education compulsory in this time period. So there was a growing need for literature that children could read. And what did they want to do? They wanted to raise moral children. And so they emphasized this idea of virtue. Because I think they were frightened about whether or not virtue could remain or would grow naturally without the emphasis on Christianity's truth.
Right. And isn't there also, like, if you're not being morally upright because of a God and his outside perspective on the right way to live, the only reason to live rightly is if it brings you pleasure, if it makes things easier for you. And so there's another element of the Victorian worldview that's kind of utilitarian.
Yes.
You be morally righteous because you'll enjoy it most.
It will go well for you.
It will go well for you, right.
And maybe that's the source of the emphasis on manners and honor and integrity and smooth relations between people.
Yep.
To bring it back around to what Emily said, there's this, the moral didactic tone in that the Victorian period is famous for, right?
Well, it just seems that the heart fell out of the Christian faith. And of course, all that was left was morality and legalism.
Yeah. So that's probably why, Emily, there's that staid picture of the high collars and the, just pleats and, I don't know,
petticoats
stiffness. Yes, just a lot and of stiffness and starchiness.
Starch, right.
And also Prunes the and emphasis, the growing emphasis on hypocrisy, you know, because it's kind of an empty moralism. When you suck the purpose, the reason for moral behavior and virtue out of the equation,
you get hypocrisy.
Well, you get hypocrisy.
Nobody loves a hypocrite like a Victorian novelist.
Yeah.
It's so funny because here we are talking about all these ideas, but when we turn to the actual famous novelists who have lasted themselves, they also clearly saw all these problems and were talking about it.
Excellent. So who are we talking about? We've heard a couple of names drop so far. We've dropped Dickens. That's the one I can remember.
We're talking about more. Dickens,
Elizabeth Gaskell.
Dickens was 1812 to 1870. Elizabeth Gaskell was 1810 to 1865.
So these are early Victorians, right?
George Eliot,
for sure.
And the Bronte sisters?
Yeah, Oscar Wilde.
Oscar Wilde's late.
Okay,
Oscar Wilde.
He is late, but he's in there. I checked
Emily has a question.
It seems that there's kind of two pathways. There's the realists, and then there's the Gothic novelists, right? Mm-hmm. And the Brontes fall into the Gothic novelists. Yes. So how does that fall into the philosophy that we've been talking
about? Pick me.
Okay, Dad's I picked Dad.
Oh, sorry, Dad's Mom. Turn.
You guys like him.
Go, Dad.
I would answer that question.
Oh, you just talked more.
I know, I talk all the time.
I would answer that question by using the Bronte sisters as example A of what I was talking about at the beginning of the hour, which is that a literary period doesn't have a start date and an end date. That a literary period is the best guess we can give as to when certain trends emerged that became the defining trends of an era. which means that there are always holdovers from a previous era and precursors to the next era. And I would call the Bronte sisters, in particular, the Wuthering Heights lady, Emily. Thank you. I remembered.
Right.
In particular, Emily, as a classic holdover from the Romantic era.
No. I don't agree. Mm. Here's why.
But I'm not done.
Well, let him finish his sentence.
You will have to wait.
I'm going
to
shoot you down.
Because I would say that the concerns, many of the concerns of her novel, and also the style of her novel, the character of the protagonist and the career of the protagonist, are textbook romantic elements. And they could have been written by Mary Shelley just as well. And so Emily Bronte is using a romantic sensibility to present her content and even her themes. She may be writing in calendar-wise in the Victorian era, but I would call her a holdover from days gone by.
See, and I think she is utilizing the romantic, in particular, the Byronic hero. Absolutely, Heathcliff is the Byronic hero. But I think that what she's doing in using romantic forms and, tropes is commenting retrospectively on romanticism, commenting on the romantic idea of a hero as this kind of brooding, dark man who's a law unto himself, and commenting on the perception of love that accompanies that trope and finding it really wanting. So I
think maybe poking some realist holes in it.
I think she's basically saying, let's look at this romantic concept. I mean, really, guys?
So would you say, Emily, that mom's treatment of the Bronte sisters kind of destroys the distinction that you were talking about between Gothic on the one hand and realist on the other hand? Is Bronte giving a realistic assessment of Gothic romance?
Well, I think that's a really interesting reading, and I like the way that it ties it together. Mm-hmm. I do think that the Victorians were also known for being spiritualists. We get like Arthur Conan Doyle, who was a famously into seances and spiritualism, which probably also falls into the idea that the center is falling out of the Christian religion.
Yeah, which is fascinating because here we are elevating science as God, and we're only going to believe in facts provable in laboratory experiments, right? But what happens then is that everybody's looking for spiritualism somewhere. We can't go to Christianity for fact anymore because we've discredited it with science purportedly. So now what are we going to do? Well, we're going to have seances to try to connect with the spirit world. There's a fascination, a fixation on spiritualism.
Yeah,
it seems to be an obvious irony from this distance, that's for sure.
Well, yeah, and it's that tension is so beautifully portrayed in Doyle, because here he was into all of those spiritualistic pursuits, and yet his books were about a man who pursued the factual, right?
Reason.
Who used facts to reason his way to truth without fail.
Okay, so I love all of this. I do think we should spend a little bit more time on Dickens. I don't know. You guys can disagree with me, but when I think Victorian period, novelists,
Dickens,
that's
Dickensian
the name,
Dickens.
Right? He is the novelist of the Victorian era.
Interesting. I didn't think of him first.
Really? Who did you think of?
Who did you think of first?
I thought of George Eliot first as a Victorian novelist.
Interesting.
And don't you think that in addition to these things, that she's also talking a lot about the suffrage in all of her books? She's talking about treatment of women. That becomes...
Who, George Eliot?
Yes. George Eliot is really interested in woman's place in society and questioning a lot of the ideas of her forerunners.
By the way, for any of our readers that are confused,
George Eliot is a woman.
Is a pseudonym adopted by a woman. Yeah.
I think that's funny because she does talk about the place of a woman in society, but I think she's even more concerned with thinking about reality. What is reality truly? And she's concerned with the disconnect between ideals, and she connects morality, living well, with the ideal realm. And she's emphasizing the disconnect between the realm of ideas and the reality in the domestic realm, trying to make... She's trying to connect people, and she's emphasizing how they can't connect with one another because they're stuck in an ideal realm. They can't relate to each other in real life because they're too busy creating their own reality in their minds. Their perceptions are in the way of their relationships. I think that's her
honesty.
Main, yeah, honesty and reality in relationships is her main concept that she's working with.
So a profound realist.
Fascinating.
Yeah, she's a profound realist.
So you get...
But maybe not quite a... Not a prolific realist, though, right? How many novels are we talking about?
Middlemarch is... It's
prolific.
It's
a hefty.
It's prolific by itself.
I'm not talking about length.
That's three of anybody else's
next to
novels.
Dickens. What I said so far is that I think Dickens is the novelist of the period. He was certainly the most famous in his own era. But I think also David Copperfield is easily as long as Middlemarch. And how many of those did she turn
she
out?
She didn't turn out as many. That's certainly true.
So.
Well, I think.
Dickens. Let's go back to Dickens.
I think this is really interesting because I do think of Dickens first, too. But it can be really confusing to talk about Dickens in connection with realism because his characters are anything but
They're
real.
Caricatures.
Oh, but the situations are real, though. And the settings are real. He's grappling with. With societal ills that are plaguing his own people in his own day.
And human ills.
He's writing about the guy next door all the time.
I think the idea...
And he's exaggerating him for effect, but that's the topic
right.
of his work.
The idea of literary realism does not preclude caricature at all.
No.
Right.
Yeah, so it doesn't necessarily have to be... It's not necessarily describing the form so much as it is the philosophy.
And
maybe,
subject matter.
Yeah, and I think when we think ultra-realism, we think Hemingway... Where he never says anything mm-hmm. that actually can't be scientifically verified. And some of it sounds boring because it's just actually real life. But that's not realism. That's modernism. And
right.
I think that's different.
Yes.
I do too.
You get the same kind of attention to dialect and regionalism when you're looking at Dickens that you would get with Twain.
Yeah. Huckleberry Finn is super implausible as a person.
Yeah.
But it's the pinnacle of American realism.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And the other thing that I was thinking of, so the other day we were watching an adaptation of Little Dorrit it was BBC, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's so good. Man, that was good. But the thing that made me chuckle is that I was expecting them to have to do these crazy makeup jobs on everyone to get anywhere near drawing these crazy, crazy characters that Dickens has penned for us. Nope. They just went out and hired people because humanity is weird, bro. People are weird. Like, he's not actually... Like, Dickens' caricatures are generally caricatures of emotion or of proclivity, not necessarily physical caricatures. I think he's just looking around at and I'm sorry if there are any British listeners to our show, but he's looking around at England and going, dude, who are these people?
I love it.
I think he's doing much what Leonardo da Vinci did with his grotesque sketches, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe mm-hmm. they were somewhat exaggerated, caricatured, cartooned, but, you know, it was coming from somewhere.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so who else? We've got George Eliot. We've got Dickens, Gaskell.
Elizabeth Gaskell. You guys, let me just put a vote in for Elizabeth Gaskell, who was, interestingly... I think that the conservatives today kind of go back to her and champion her because she was an early free market economist.
It's not the conservatives necessarily. It's the free market people specifically. They love Elizabeth Gaskell. As opposed to Charles Dickens. They say, "You give me your Dickens and I'll give you my Gaskell instead," like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So the North and the South and wives and daughters. And let me say that again. The North and the South. North and South. Not the North.
Just North
and South.
Get those
North and South and wives
out of there.
And daughters. She liked those kinds of titles. You know, those two-word titles. This and this and this and that. But anyway, what a great novelist. She's so much fun to read.
Yeah, they're great.
And also tells a wonderful love story.
Elizabeth Gaskell.
So what about some of these other authors who have now sort of been relegated to the children's fiction shelves, but were originally writing for grown-ups? Go ahead,
Dad. The best Victorian novelist of all is Robert Louis Stevenson in that.
Yeah.
He's great.
1850 to 1865 or 70. No, he lived longer than that. I can't remember when he died. But anyway, he lived his entire life in the Victorian period. And I think for pure novelistic skill, I think he's the greatest. And he's writing for younger people, maybe even at the time. So his stories have...
Well, at the time, I read that at the time he was writing for grown-ups, but he was writing so that it would be popular and sell books because he was trying to make a living.
He was trying not to starve.
Right. But yeah. So there's a simplicity to his stories that is both engaging and also really, really compelling. And it was interesting, as you guys were talking about the philosophy of the Victorian worldview a minute ago, I was thinking, how does that all apply to... Stevenson, who doesn't appear to be super philosophically preoccupied. But all of his novels have to do with what is a human being?
A human nature issue.
They have to do with, mm-hmm. with human nature. And you could fit his concerns into that larger idea of where do we find our moorings mm-hmm. in this world that somehow is doesn't have a stay anymore.
He's very interested unhooked. in character, you know, yeah. character as virtue.
Yeah. So I would vote for Stevenson.
Wasn't he also a Scottish Presbyterian?
He was a Scottish. I'm not sure how religious he was.
Yeah, he came from a Scottish yeah. Presbyterian family, but he himself fell away from the church. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I could at least explain his awareness of those issues in writing about human nature a lot. The Scots, man.
You know, when you're looking at children's literature in the Victorian period, there are so many names, it's hard to know where to begin.
Lewis Carroll.
George MacDonald.
Can we just stop with George MacDonald for a minute?
Yes,
who
we can.
Not only was the father of the modern fantasy novel, but also he, in his own lifetime, developed a little cadre of authors and poets that would come to his home and spend time with him. And he was essentially, because he was a Christian man, he was ministering to them. And this little artistic community just was drawn to him, and he influenced so many authors. Lewis Carroll was one of them. He had influence on, if I'm not mistaken, he had influence on J.M. Barrie, is that right?
I don't know.
I didn't know that.
I don't know.
But anyway, if you go read about George MacDonald, you'll be surprised at all of the people that he influenced both personally and artistically with his own fairy tales, right? He wrote a lot of fairy tales, a lot of mythopoeic fiction. And you can see it in the works of other contemporaries during the period. Ian, I thought for sure you were going to talk about your favorite novelist from the period, also from children's literature. I was trying not to steal your thunder.
No pressure, dude.
Kenneth Graham.
Yeah, no pressure.
Kenneth Graham.
Oh, Kenneth Graham. For a second, I completely forgot he was a Victorian.
Well, he's a little late. Wendy Willis is a little late.
1908.
Yes. 7 years late.
And let's see, he lived 1859 to 1932.
Yeah, he'd be one of those... holdovers from the Victorian straddling. Period, yeah.
Yeah,
I do love Kenneth Graham.
He published The Reluctant Dragon in 1898, so that's firmly in the period.
It counts! Yeah.
Also, Rudyard Kipling. He's in the period, yes?
He is?
Well, there also, the colonialism was also a big deal during this time, right? This is when the British Empire is being formed and prospering. Mm-hmm. So Kipling, absolutely. Mm-hmm. What about the later authors, men like Thomas Hardy or Oscar Wilde, mentioned earlier? Yeah. Would you say that they are precursors to modernism rather than properly Victorian?
That's what I was going to say about Hardy and Wilde both. Yeah. That they're troubled by the failure, maybe. This is probably a lot to say, but they're troubled by the failure of the Victorian world to answer those questions that we're talking about are giving up a little in the search for them, which is, of course, a hallmark of the modernist period that follows.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting that. I definitely see that in Oscar Wilde, for sure, that he's fed up with the hypocrisy that we were mentioning earlier. His A Portrait of Dorian Gray is a study of moralism, really, and it's an unveiling of the hypocrisy of the human spirit, and it's shockingly...
acerbic.
Yeah, that's a good word for it. I think it's realism, perhaps, but it's definitely a precursor of modernism. It's very, very dark and biting.
That's true of his importance of being earnest also. Even though it's just from the title.
Even though it's fun, it's also sort of sarcastic and biting.
Yeah, it's satirizing the period and the ideals.
So I think my answer to that question, Emily, which I think is a really good one, is that I'd put those guys at the end that come up late. Mm-hmm. I'd see them as already anticipating the next literary period, even though anybody who's periodizing Hardy puts him in the Victorian era for sure.
Mm-hmm. What about those that were just a little early for the Victorian period? For example, these guys are not English, so maybe we don't want to talk about them at all, but The Brothers Grimm, Grimm's Fairy Tales, was published 1812 and 1815 in two volumes. Mm. Hans Christian Andersen's Fairy Tales was published in 1835 in Denmark. So
I think the classic example of people that come early is Jane Austen. Jane Austen.
Regency period.
Some people say, just assume that's the classic Victorian novel, except it was published in 12 or 13 or 15 or something, 20 full years before Victoria ascends the throne. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of similarities, the emphasis on manners, the emphasis on behavior, the emphasis on some sort of social structure that holds society together because nothing down at the heart is really doing the job anymore. It sounds very Victorian. I think she's a great precursor.
What it means is that you can see that all these things are on a continuum, that intellectual...
Right. Like Dad was talking
about.
Yeah,
the ideas, then the cross currents of those ideas in society were causing reactions in the periods that followed them. Mm. It's very interesting. Mm.
You've been talking about children's literature, and it's all of the golden age children's literature. But what we said at the beginning was that the moralism and didacticism was showing up in children's literature during this time. This is the time of Elsie Dismore, right? Mm.
Sorry, was that out loud?
Whoa.
Tell me what you really think.
Sorry, I made you read that
all
those years.
Sorry to any of our listeners who like those.
Well, it's just, I just think it's important to notice that what we were saying earlier isn't true of everything that you've been mentioning, but that there was definitely that strain of didacticism.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think one way to look at Stevenson is that he's a little didactic. The whole point of the preaching. Black Arrow is the main character learning to tell the truth and be an upright and honest boy, you know, and that's Jim true. Hawkins wins when he's honorable and loses when he's dishonorable. I mean, it's pretty didactic, but
Dickens, bless his heart, is always on the nose.
Yeah, Dickens is right
always
on the nose.
Dickens is
splitting the nose right down the middle.
So I don't know. I mean, it's didactic, yes, but that maybe that isn't a drawback if you understand it in the context of this is a society where, as Mom's been saying, Darwin has blown up like a bomb down at the foundation and everybody's scrambling looking for what to replace God with.
Although it seems to me then that Little Dorrit may actually be the perfect Victorian novel because he combats that in the end with Amy Dorrit.
No argument here.
It's beautiful stuff. It really is.
I'm always reminded when I'm thinking of Little Dorrit of an ad for It's a Wonderful Life that I saw when I was a kid. And the guy said, Capricorn, right? But what, I ask you, could be better than that? Making fun of everybody who pans it for being so on the nose, as Emily says.
Oh, man, that's awesome.
Well, as we usually do at the end of a lit period, I want to give everybody a chance, without interruption, without being gainsaid, to recommend their favorite book from the period to our listeners. Mm. And I think we're going to go in order of age, youngest to oldest, this time around. So it falls to Megan to begin.
Oh, man. Well, I do think I would recommend Middlemarch. I think it's a great representation of all of the themes of the period. And on top of that, it's a brilliant set of character studies, and it's really funny. If you keep in mind that she's trying to be comedic and she's not intending that you take all of her characters at face value, there's just a lot of depth and a lot of enjoyment to be had in those 800 plus pages.
Sweet.
She's writing, is she a contemporary of Austen? I think she is. Maybe just a little later.
I think she's
Austen.
A little later than Austen, but she writes with the same kind of flair.
And wit.
Yeah,
she's a little
she's very witty.
She's a little more sarcastic than Austen was. Austen was always sunnier.
Well, Austen's humor, you can tell she's trying to be funny from the very first line of each of her books. And for me, George Eliot, it took me a minute to realize that she was laying it on pretty thick because she wanted me to think it was funny. So it took me a couple chapters with Eliot, whereas with Austen, it's right away.
Eliot's a little more cerebral.
Yeah, a little bit. But I think she's worth it.
Yeah, I do too. I agree.
They were not contemporaries.
What was the difference? In
Jane Austen died 2 years before George Eliot was born.
Okay. So the best you could say is she was writing in a tradition.
Yeah. And also that Jane Austen was a precursor, like I was saying. I think that's the best explanation. Jane Austen's before her time.
Anyway, George Eliot is mine.
Yeah. Love it.
If you need an easy way in to George Eliot, you can wait on Middlemarch and start with Silas Marner.
Silas Marner, yeah.
It's very short.
Don't wait on Middlemarch.
Nonetheless,
it's
weird.
Great.
Middlemarch is great, but you can kind of get to know her a little in a shorter context before you jump in.
Mom, choose your own book.
Yeah, Mom. Okay, right. Yeah, Mom, choose your own book. We sorry, said no game
sorry,
to your
sorry.
Turn.
Okay, it's not my turn. Get off my book and choose
your
turn. Bad.
You're going, what's this about?
You're going last. Chosen.
What's this about not being gainsaid? I think Ian said that.
I'm sorry.
I did say
sorry.
That. Okay. All right. My turn to pick. I am so torn between recommendations for two different children's books. Part of me wants to recommend Robert Louis Stevenson, and part of me wants to recommend George MacDonald.
It's not fair recommending two. There's a rule here.
Yeah.
You recommend right, the boy's book, choose. And I'll recommend the other. Just kidding.
Okay, I'm gonna recommend Stevenson, and I think I'm going to go with Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Ooh, good choice.
That's a good one.
And I think the reason I would recommend that book is because it is maybe, which is funny because on its surface, it looks to be one of his more moralistic efforts. But I think if you read it carefully, it is maybe his least moralistic book and has the most to say about human nature and in particular about brokenness and compassion.
Yeah.
So go read that one with a pair of grown-up eyes, and I think you'll get a lot out of it. Mm-hmm. Okay, Emily, it's your turn.
Well, you took mine.
Sorry.
So I'm not really sure what to do now because I can't do Dickens because I can't take that one away.
Why not? You're first.
Get to do
it. I'm not the Dickens. Well, it's true. It's true. Okay, I am actually going to recommend Sherlock Holmes because this is when the detective novel came onto the scene for the reasons that we talked about earlier. And that's the collected works of Sherlock Holmes is just a great time because of all the reasons that I sit down to read Agatha Christie. Mm-hmm. It's just, love a great mystery.
Love it. Sir beautiful. Arthur Conan Doyle, ladies and gentlemen.
Guys, we're covering the waterfront beautifully at this point. Two to go. I believe Dad's next.
You're totally
my family
accentuating
lore and legend correctly.
Then I'm the old lady in the group.
So it's my turn, and since no one has mentioned this author yet, maybe because out of deference to me as the grand old man of the family, and I have no idea, but I'm going to recommend Charles Dickens, and you could hardly go wrong by picking a Dickens novel at random, and you could hardly lose by choosing his what I believe to be his greatest novel, Little Dorrit. However, if you have never read Great Expectations, your literary education is not yet complete. And so Great Expectations
agreed
would go on my list even ahead of Little Dorrit in terms of priority for understanding and experiencing the Victorian novel, because it is probably the most perfect expression of what a Victorian reader expected of a great novel. So it's not only a wonderful literary experience, but also a little glimpse into the Victorian period of English readers. It was a spectacular overnight success. All of the critics at the time and since have said it's his masterpiece. It is perfection, novelistic perfection, and it's just a wonderful story. Great Expectations. Don't leave home without it.
Oh, what a great ride. You couldn't be more right about that one. I didn't know it was a huge commercial success in its day, though. That's really interesting. Well, we turn finally to Mom. Mom, the reason that I put you at the end of the line is because you know more about this than any of us and had the best shot at still having something to recommend after four people.
Yeah, and you're the oldest.
Ha, ha, ha.
Yeah, and you're the oldest.
Don't you forget it.
All right, Mama, what's it going to be? Send us off into the rest of our week with a great book recommendation.
Okay, so I'm going to go with George MacDonald, At the Back of the North Wind, which is my favorite George MacDonald story. Mythopoeic literature at its best. You get a little bit of a fairy tale, a little bit of myth. Beautiful story about a little boy who's a bit sickly. Everybody calls him touched in the head. His name's Diamond. And it traces his experience with this fantastic mythic woman, North Wind, who appears to him at night and takes him off on these wild adventures in which he confronts the problem of pain and evil in the world. And MacDonald's treatment of this idea is so sensitive. He's writing in a period where the infant mortality rate is like off the charts, and he himself loses children. He's previously been a Congregationalist pastor, but was raised Scottish Presbyterian, Reformed Presbyterian, had a very close relationship with his father, and believed that fatherhood was actually at the heart of the universe. Because his relationship with his dad was so personally rich and redemptive. His understanding of the Father God is equally so. And so his treatment of this subject matter is just profound and moving. It may be the best treatment of the subject of the problem of pain that I've ever read. And it's written in language that a child could understand. So I can't recommend it.
Wow. Highly.
It would help if the child was living in 1880, though. I mean, it's a little bit archaic in terms
of the
child
had a
college education.
That's true.
It's beautiful for all those reasons. Also, it's like going to Trip Town.
It is a little strange. Super beautiful, though. Like, not to gainsay. This is not a gainsay. There's no gainsay
yeah,
in here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, mythopoeic literature is myth and poetry, so you have to read it not literally. It's not realism, like you're talking about Dickens being realism. But it is treating real subject matters, right? Real issues of concern in his period and in the human life and psyche. And his use of myth and poetry is to add an implicit element to the story that gets beyond the natural world and allows him to talk about spiritual realities, which is a beautiful thing, especially for the Victorians.
Mm. Wow. Well, that is a great... I think if a reader were to go and get those five, they would have a pretty good sense of what's going on in the Victorian period and would have had a great summer spending time with those authors. So thank you all for tossing in your oar. That was great. I had such a great time just now. Let's do it again soon. One, two.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
All right. In the meantime, my friends, happy reading.
Happy reading.
Happy reading.
Bibliophiles is a production of the Center for Lit Podcast Network. Find new episodes each month on the web at centerforlit.com, where you'll discover dozens of resources to equip and inspire you to participate in the great conversation, including the Pelican Society, a membership program for folks who love the Center for Lit approach to all things literary. Thanks for joining us. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Until next time, happy reading, everyone.